mean gain for other countries.
And that's exactly what it is. It's a brain gain for China, for Spain, for France, for Germany, on and go. Oh, and Canada, too. And by the way, also Australia. So they're all jumping on the bandwagon. And I guess we'll just have a dumbed down society. That's where we're headed. And I'm not so sure, but with certain segments of it aren't already right there already.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Robert Hunsaker. We are going to link to your piece for Dissident Voice, America's Great Brain Drain, as well as your other articles around the issue of the climate catastrophe. That does it for our broadcast. Happy birthday to Tamari Astudio. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a director of technology as well as a director of audience. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taracena, Tammy Warren of Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Anjali Kamat, Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Ozbeck, Emily Anderson, Dante Torrieri, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. By the way, Buffy, happy, happy birthday. If you want to sign up for our Daily Digest, our newsletter, go to Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
It's time to pack your bags and join us for Camp KBOO. Make a summer of memories with KBOO and support grassroots media by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give to help us reach our $50,000 goal by June 29th. Thank you.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's special election results are mostly in.
The new Portland City Council faces approving its first budget.
And in international news, Pope Leo makes his first general address, specifically calling out events in Gaza.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 21st, 2025. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Josh Salem. Portland City Council is convening today to discuss amendments to the mayor's proposed budget and to approve the city's roughly $8.5 billion in operations for the upcoming fiscal year. The marathon meeting could last as long as 12 hours as councilors debate some 126 amendments to the mayor's proposal. That plan balances a deficit of more than $100 million by increasing certain fees, finding savings from the current year, and cobbling together a host of one-time outside funding sources. It also increases funding for public safety, specifically the Portland Police Bureau. PBB's current budget is roughly $308 million. The mayor proposed a $318 million budget for the Bureau in the upcoming fiscal year. Wilson's proposal does include cuts to Portland Parks and Recreation. Some city councilors already proposed amendments to take some of the additional police funding and allocate it to parks, the Bureau of Transportation, violence prevention, and other city programs. Other amendments give the council more oversight of overtime spending by police and fire bureaus. By law, the city's budget committee must approve the budget by midnight. The council aims to have the deliberations done by 11 p.m. tonight. Items adopted should stick. In fact, state law limits the changes that can be made after the budget's approval unless the city republishes the budget and holds another public hearing. The council is expected to adopt the budget on June 18th. The public is also expected to provide 2 hours of public commentary today.
Oregon voters weighed a number of issues in a special election yesterday, including whom to elect to their local school and community college boards and whether or not to approve key money measures. Election offices began announcing results at 8 p.m. last night. Voters in all 36 Oregon counties cast ballots. There were no statewide measures in play. Portland Public Schools had asked for a $1.83 billion bond measure to fund school modernization and construction, and it looks like that measure narrowly passed. The bond maintains the 2017 property tax rate of $2.50, that's $2.50, per $1,000 of assessed value. There were contested races for four seats on the board of Portland Public Schools. In Zone 1, Government Relations Coordinator Christy Splitt, who was appointed to an open seat on the board in January, appears to have won. In Zone 4, Rochelle Chase Miller, the statewide program director at Smart Reading, a children's literacy nonprofit, defeated incumbent Herman Green. In Zone 5, communications strategist Virginia Lafort appears to have beaten Jorge Sanchez Batista, a senior at McDaniel High School, who surprisingly received notable teachers' union support. In Zone 6, public defender Stephanie Engelsman easily defeated software company owner Rob Galanakis and disaster resilience consultant Simone Crow. A $136 million bond measure would have helped Mount Hood Community College make improvements to its 1970s-era buildings, including earthquake retrofitting and updating original heating, cooling, and wiring systems. Like the six others before it, this measure appeared headed for defeat as of this morning by less than 3%. The Tigard-Tualatin School District was seeking approval of a $421.3 million bond, the first time the district has put forward a construction bond since 2016. As of midnight, the results were virtually deadlocked, with 50.3% voting in favor of the bond and 49.7% against it, with an overall difference of about 100 votes. In the 1,600-student Gladstone School District, voters rejected a request for a $70 million bond aimed at addressing a variety of maintenance and upgrade projects.
The Justice Department announced today it would be ending efforts to secure agreements for federal oversight of police departments in Minneapolis and Louisville following the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, respectively. It will also be ending investigations or retracting findings of constitutional violations regarding police departments in Phoenix, Memphis, Trenton, Mount Vernon, Oklahoma City, and the Louisiana State Police. The Justice Department said, quote, "Overbroad police consent decrees divest local control of policing from communities where it belongs, turning that power over to unelected and unaccountable bureaucrats, often with an anti-police agenda," end quote. Right-wing figures are pushing for the pardon of Derek Chauvin, the Minneapolis policeman convicted of murdering George Floyd almost 5 years ago on May 25th of 2020.
In national news, Kristi Noem doesn't know what habeas corpus is. The Senate passes a no taxes on tips bill, and there are wins for Native Americans in the West. With these stories and more, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Habeas corpus is a constitutional right that the president has to be able to remove people from this country
That's incorrect.
Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem's description of the constitutional right during a Senate hearing dissatisfied Democratic New Hampshire Senator Maggie Hansen. Habeas corpus is the due process for challenging an arrest and requires the government to justify detaining someone. The Trump administration has complained that due process protections bog down mass deportations, and White House advisor Stephen Miller said they're looking at suspending habeas corpus. Groups fighting hunger say they fear the threat of detention will prevent immigrants from getting food assistance. Jacob Spirati with Northwest Harvest runs two food distribution programs that serve migrants, among others.
We believe that access to food is a basic human right, and people shouldn't fear needing to get food. And so we just continue to make our spaces as open and welcoming as we can.
The United Nations says no aid has been distributed in Gaza despite a few trucks entering as a blockade is lifted. Israel faces criticism from the UK, Canada, and France, and UN officials say 14,000 babies could die within days unless they get aid. The White House says it's stepping back from demands for a ceasefire in Ukraine and from a European push for more Russia sanctions. Pressure from President Donald Trump does not seem to have dislodged House GOP opponents to his big, beautiful budget bill, balancing demands for deeper cuts with higher deductions for local taxes and protecting Medicaid is proving difficult given the narrow majority. According to the New York Times, the bill would push federal debt to an all-time high. Trump and Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth unveiled their plans for protection from missile attacks through what they're calling the Golden Dome. The estimated $175 billion project would deploy missile sensing and destroying satellites by the end of Trump's term. The Senate has passed a bipartisan bill to eliminate federal taxes on tips, one of Trump's campaign promises. Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen says that will help ease pressures on many tipped workers in her home state.
Nevada has more tipped workers per capita than any other state. So this bill would mean immediate financial relief for countless hardworking families.
Montana advocacy group Western Native Voice has been organizing meetings aimed at boosting Native American civic engagement. Montana's former state superintendent of public instruction, Denise Juno, says it's working.
There was a sense of pride in seeing what got accomplished through the 12 Native legislators who got elected from all these different communities. And I think really a glimmer of hope about what can happen when people get engaged.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Following on to what we just heard on 2025 Talks, ICE activity is preventing Washington migrants from getting needed food. Isabel Charlet tells us more.
Immigrants' rights advocates are voicing concern that migrant communities in Washington may be avoiding visiting food banks or getting food assistance due to fear of detention by federal immigration agents. Jacob Sperati with Northwest Harvest runs two food distribution programs serving local communities, including many immigrants in Seattle and Yakima. He says migrants, whether they're documented or not, already encounter many obstacles in accessing food, from language barriers to a lack of familiar options to needing to show an ID.
We believe that access to food is a basic human right, and people shouldn't fear needing to get food. And so we just continue to make our spaces as open and welcoming as we can.
Research shows immigrants make up more than 75% of Washington's agricultural workforce, and yet immigrants and refugees are more likely to experience food insecurity. Washington's sanctuary laws limit the involvement of local law enforcement in federal immigration efforts. A statement by Washington Republican Party Chairman Jim Walsh says federal laws should override state immigration laws. A former defense attorney, Jay Stancil, argues the pressure on immigration officers to detain more people is leading to illegal tactics.
We've seen the behavior of immigration enforcement, whether it's ICE or Homeland Security or the Border Patrol, carried out in increasingly lawless ways, unconstitutional ways.
Stancil says no one is required to answer questions from law enforcement. He adds businesses, including food banks and grocery stores, are allowed to ask immigration agents to leave.
Say, well, you are not here for food, and your presence is disrupting our mission to provide food for the public. We're asking you to leave. You do not have permission to be here.
Governor Bob Ferguson signed three bills last week aimed at further protecting immigrants' rights. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Some 19% of the United States electricity comes from nuclear plants. Many Oregonians have long opposed that source of power. Now, Oregon groups have a new proposal to rally against. Brett Pivato has more on the story.
As Oregon legislators consider the possibility of allowing a nuclear reactor in Umatilla County, opponents rallied at the state capitol this week to voice their concerns. In 1980, Oregon voters approved Measure 7, a statewide ban on building new nuclear reactors. But House Bill 2410 would exempt Umatilla County from the ban and allow local voters to decide on building a small modular reactor. Kelly Campbell with Columbia Riverkeeper says what the state actually needs is more clean energy alternatives.
This is a new program that costs new money that we don't have. And especially with this kind of budget forecast, the idea of wasting money on a pie-in-the-sky nuclear fantasy, one really... We need more solar, more wind, more battery storage, more energy efficiency.
On Monday, environmental groups, tribal leaders, and Northeast Oregon community groups held a No Nuclear Day of Action that included meetings with state legislators. Small modular reactors, or SMRs, are built in factories, then shipped to sites. They typically produce 300 megawatts or less electricity per unit. Industry experts cite their lower cost over existing gigawatt-scale reactors, but a 2022 study found SMRs produce a greater volume of of waste that is also more reactive. The bill would allow high-level radioactive waste to be stored on site so long as the federal operating license is in force. It doesn't resolve the issue of permanent storage. Campbell says Umatilla County is already one of the most polluted places in the state.
It is somewhat of a sacrifice zone, right? It's seen as a place that you could do things like this. It's a place where people have nitrates in their drinking water way over the EPA limits. It's a place where things get dumped.
Measure 7 forbids new nuclear reactors until two conditions are met, that a national waste repository has been built, and Oregon voters statewide approve a new nuclear plant site certificate. For Oregon News Service, I'm Brett Pivito.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU's News in Depth. You'll hear Karina Brown from Portland Street Roots discussing flaws in our emergency dispatch system. It's 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio, followed at 7 by Hard Knock Radio. At 8, it's Drinking from Puddles. Tonight's weather shows considerable cloudiness, with a 50% chance of rain. The low will be 52. Tomorrow's weather calls for showers in the morning. The high will be 63. Today in history, in 1927, aviator Charles Lindbergh completes the world's first solo, nonstop flight across the Atlantic Ocean. The quote of the day is from nurse and educator Clara Barton, who established the American Red Cross on this day in 1881. Barton said, "You must never so much think as whether you like it or not, whether it is bearable or not. You must never think of anything except the need and how to meet it."
Pope Leo XIV made a statement today calling for humanitarian aid to reach the Gaza Strip and for an end to what he called a heartbreaking toll on its people. This came as he presided over his first general audience in St. Peter's Square in Vatican City. About 40,000 people were in the audience, with the speech coming just days after an estimated 200,000 people attended the inaugural Mass on Sunday by the first American Pope. Pope Leo, formerly Cardinal Robert Prevost of Chicago, began with a tour through the piazza in the Popemobile, stopping to bless several babies. Leo spoke in English, fluent Spanish, and the traditional Italian of the papacy. He said, quote, "I renew my heartfelt appeal to allow the entrance of dignified humanitarian aid to Gaza and to put an end to the hostilities whose heartbreaking price is being paid by children, the elderly, and sick people," end quote. The general audience on Wednesdays is a weekly appointment that popes have kept for decades, to allow the ordinary faithful an opportunity for a face-to-face encounter with the pontiff. It usually has the pope delivering a reflection on a theme or scripture passage, with summaries provided by others in different languages, and the pope addressing specific messages to particular faith groups. The encounter, which lasts more than an hour, usually ends with a brief topical appeal by the pope about a current issue or upcoming event. Leo began with his now frequent mantra, "Peace be with you." Leo had previously affirmed the Vatican's willingness to host the next round of ceasefire talks between Russia and Ukraine.
School cell phone bans do not actually date back all that far. In 2023, Florida was the first state to pass a law regulating their use. Now, just 2 years later, half of all states have laws in place, with many more apparently coming soon. Bills have moved through legislatures this year in both blue and red states like New York and Oklahoma, likely reflecting a broad consensus that phones are bad for children. Connecticut State Representative Jennifer Leeper, a Democrat and co-chair of the General Assembly's Education Committee, recently called phones, quote, "a cancer on our kids, driving isolation and loneliness, decreasing attention, and having major impacts both on social, emotional well-being, but also learning," end quote. Georgia's bill, which only bans phones in grades K through 8, passed in March. Republican Representative Scott Hilton said, quote, "This is a mental health bill. It's a public safety bill," end quote. So far, 25 states have passed laws, with 8 other states in the District of Columbia implementing rules or at least making recommendations to local districts. 16 states have acted this year. Just this Tuesday, Alaska lawmakers required schools to regulate cell phones, overriding an education package that Republican Governor Mike Dunleavy had vetoed for unrelated reasons. Bills await a governor's signature or veto in Florida, Missouri, Nebraska, and New Hampshire. Florida originally just banned phones during teaching time, while allowing them between classes or at lunch. But now there's another bill awaiting Governor Ron DeSantis' decision. That one would ban phones for the entire school day for elementary and middle schools.
Nine states and the District of Columbia have enacted school day bans, which now outnumber the seven states with instructional time bans. The so-called bell-to-bell bans have been promoted in part by Excel in Ed, the education think tank founded by former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. The group thinks barring phones throughout the day heads off problems outside of class, like when students stage and then record fights in hallways. Other states, particularly where there are strong traditions of local school control, are mandating only that school districts adopt, quote, some kind of cell phone policy, without specifying details. And there are still a few states where no action has been taken. There's also a growing consensus around exceptions to the bans. Most states are letting students use electronic devices to monitor medical needs and to meet the terms of special education plans. Some are allowing exceptions for translation devices if English isn't a student's first language. There are more unusual exceptions, too. South Carolina's original policy allowed an exception for students who are volunteer firefighters. At least one state allows smartwatches as long as they are not being used for communication. The most high-profile exception relates to allowing cell phone use in case of emergencies. One of the most common parent objections to the bans is that they would not be able to contact their child in an emergency, for example, a school shooting. Some laws call for schools to find other ways for parents to communicate with their children at schools, but most lawmakers say they support giving students access to their cell phones after the immediate danger has passed. Not surprisingly, many students oppose the bans, arguing that instead schools should teach responsible use. Most states provide no funding to carry out the laws. Only a few states have provided money for lockable phone storage. For example,
Long-term law enforcement funding on Montana's Flathead Reservation seems more secure. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull. A long-standing argument over funding for law enforcement on Northwest Montana's Flathead Reservation is over for now. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports Governor Greg Gianforte has signed off on funding to help county and tribal officials hash out a long-term plan.
For years, Lake County and Governor Gianforte have sparred over who's financially responsible for prosecuting tribal members for felonies on the Flathead Reservation. Lake County has historically done that work under an agreement known as Public Law 280, but the county says it can no longer afford that service. Both the county and the state had planned to leave the agreement. That would mean federal law enforcement would take over, but federal officials have said they don't have the resources. This session, county, state, and Confederated Salish and Kootenai officials hashed out a plan. The state is providing $6 million over the next 2 years to help transition more cases to tribal courts. CSKT spokesperson Rob McDonald says some of that work has already started.
We have, in the past 18 months or so, taken on more than 150 felonies and increased our efforts to reduce the workload on the county.
But Lake County is expected to continue handling more serious felonies that require prison time. The CSKT and Lake County are required under the new law to hash out an agreement, laying out the balance of cases each will take on. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
This month has seen many awareness events across Indian country for missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and people. This included an event in Gresham, Oregon, organized by MMIW Search and Hope Alliance. Honor songs were sung with dancing. And people affected by the murders or disappearances of Native people shared their stories before an audience.
It was January 9th, 2024.
Kim Lenning is founder of MMIW Search and Hope Alliance. She says there was power in what people shared about their missing or murdered relatives.
The power lies in experience.
so many times people say they understand, but sometimes they don't. And they don't understand because they haven't seen it firsthand from experience. So when you bring in surviving family members that are still searching for their loved ones, it brings a different environment of emotion to the audience that's listening.
While many cases remain unsolved, one outcome brought relief. Luann Aiken, a member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians of North Dakota, was found alive on May 10th in Portland, Oregon, after a two-year disappearance. Lenning says she verified it was Aiken, then contacted her relatives.
A lot of tears, a lot of relieved emotions, and some sadness because of the situation. She'd been missing for so long. We did offer them help if they needed help to come out and take Luann home if Luann chose to go home. We're just letting them as a family kind of figure that out. And if they so choose to take us up on that, then we have offered them to bring them out here so that they can travel as a family back home to North Dakota.
Lenning says her organization will hit its one-year anniversary in July. She says the celebration will focus on volunteers who keep things going. Lenning says while MMIW Search and Hope Alliance is largely a regional effort, they try to help with national cases. This includes the Oklahoma City case of Seneca Shimeme, whose family says he was killed in a deliberate hit and run last October. Missing and murdered indigenous events will continue through May. Those who want to get involved can contact their tribes or look up community calendars. You're listening to National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
Ransomware attacks are now the leading cause of healthcare data breaches. Almost 300 million patient records have been compromised over the last decade and a half. Crystal Blair has more on the story from Minnesota.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull. A longstanding argument over...
According to researchers from Michigan State University, Yale, and Johns Hopkins, ransomware is now the leading culprit behind U.S. health data breaches. Ransomware is malicious software that hijacks a victim's files or systems and holds them hostage for money. At least four Michigan hospitals have been hit in recent years, including Michigan Medicine, which had more than 55,000 patients affected. McLaren Healthcare topped the list with 2.5 million records breached. The study reveals that nationwide, hackers have exposed 285 million patient records over the past 15 years. Michigan State professor John Jiang, who led the research, says these cyber crooks are hunting for specific data.
They're looking for social security numbers, driver license, you know, individual birth date, because they could to use this information to commit fraud or selling on the black market.
Jiang points out that healthcare providers don't have a lot of cybersecurity resources, so he says it's crucial to protect the most sensitive information first. For example, setting up separate systems to handle personal information. In 2024, ransomware was behind just 11% of healthcare breaches nationwide, but it did the most damage, compromising about 70% of all patient records. This new research builds on earlier studies showing that internal mistakes, not hackers, caused over half of healthcare data breaches, including lost devices and misdirected emails. Jiang warns that these breaches can also pose serious risk to patients' health.
This person is allergic to certain medicine, right? If the hackers mess up the system or, you know, modified whatever information, that could cost life-changing event.
The researchers suggest that federal regulators should require hospitals and insurers to report ransomware attacks, change how they measure breach severity to include care disruptions, and track cryptocurrency to stop ransom payments. For the Michigan News Connection, I'm Crystal Blair.
Unlike most politicians, KBOO news poet Dan Raphael only wants power over himself.
Joe Biden has terminal cancer. When did he know? As a longtime power addict, Biden had little choice but to run for re-election. He needed to feed his Jones. Power corrupts, and America has been the absolute power for decades, so is absolutely corrupted. These days you can't be president without needing more power, probably already a power junkie. To rule is to be cruel. There's never enough of everything to go around. A rising tide lifts all boats, but most of us are in dinghies or kayaks while a handful have yachts. How do we get America sober again, or can we? Power's ability to addict and corrupt can only be weakened by each of us taking some power back. Not power over others, but power over ourselves. Like saying, no, I don't want that fast food burger. No, I don't want AI bringing back nuclear power. I do want everyone to know America's full history so we can further weaken the addictive grip of power on ourselves and our world. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 21st, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael. The producer is Josh Salem, and our engineers are Ray Bodwell and Hannah Francis. Special thanks to Brett Pivoteau, Isabel Charlet, Crystal Blair, Alex Gonzalez, and Brian Bull. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Street Roots Managing Editor Karina Brown to talk about one of the latest stories from the paper. It's called Snowed Under. Summer is fast approaching. One 2023 death reveals how Portland's emergency systems leave homeless residents vulnerable.